once we become of a certain age and we don't understand why the younger generation is reacting to things the way that they are, we think, well, this time is different because I am witnessing it myself. I can't relate to these kids. Something has to be wrong here. The intellectual response to that is, no, that's literally what everyone has said since the beginning of time, but that's a really hard thing for us to emotionally process.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof. So I'm excited for this episode since we've been trying to record it for almost 2.5 months. Jason Pfeiffer is the editor-in-chief of Entrepreneur Magazine, and he's the host of Problem Solvers, a podcast about entrepreneurs solving unexpected problems in their business. He also has another podcast, which I largely want to talk to him about today, Pessimist's Archive. He has been an editor at Men's Health, Fast Company, Maxim, and Boston Magazine. And he's written for a few other publications, Washington Post, Slate, New York, among others. It's really a little bit envious of this guy. And he's also the author of a novel, Mr. Nice Guy, which came out last year, which he co-wrote with his wife. So I'm really excited to jump into a lot of different topics in the time we have together. So, yeah, Jason, welcome to Future Proof.
Hey, thanks for having me. And thanks for throwing every possible bit of my bio into that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think should you just maybe for your bio just list like the three things that you haven't, you know, contributed to in some way?
Yeah, I feel kind of awkward when people use the entire thing. And I do a lot of public speaking, so sometimes it's literally somebody standing up on stage like listing off all that stuff, and I am afraid that the audience is thinking like, what an asshole that he made this person say all this stuff. And it's just the bio. You can use whatever you want. But I don't know. I don't know how to write a good bio. I don't know what I'm supposed to say in the bio.
Yeah, you have no experience writing, right? Of course.
Yeah.
I think that there's so many different things that we can talk about. And I think in the limited time that we have together, I know that you're a student of a number of different things, and you research a number of different topics simultaneously. So before we kind of dive into Pessimist's Archive, mm-hmm. and why I wanted to talk to you about that, what are some of the topics in general that you're most intrigued by at the moment?
You know, the big topic that is the umbrella subject for everything that I do, and I came to this after I started doing it all. I was looking for what is the thread? What is the thing that pushes me? And the answer is change, that I'm really interested in change because it is at once the thing that defines us and the thing that we resist the most. And that is fascinating. And I give this talk all the time when conferences or whatever will hire me, and I'll give this talk about the need to embrace change and the ways that I see people embrace change. And I was afraid when I first started doing it that it was going to come off as too simplistic or too obvious. But I give this talk to large groups of people who are very accomplished, and they all come up to me afterwards and are like, that was a really valuable reminder. I need to be thinking more about that. And what I've learned is that we all know that change is necessary. We are all in some way or another the product of change. And yet we all reach some point where change stops being full of opportunity and starts to just be uncomfortable. And we need to push through that. So I find that really interesting. And that is ultimately what Entrepreneur is about. It's about what entrepreneurship is about. It's what Entrepreneur Magazine is about. And it's very much what Pessimist Archive is about.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's a perfect transition. But so let me make sure to ruin that transition and instead ask you a lightning round of irreverent questions just to kind of get to know the folks who we speak to.
Sure. Who needs a transition?
Okay, so I know that you've spoken in quite a few places. What's your favorite city to travel for business?
Oh, L.A., because I have a bunch of friends there that I never otherwise get to see. And I actually kind of like L.A. I thought I was going to hate L.A., but I like it. I don't like it enough to move there, but I like it.
Well, fair and nice and succinct. How about talking about change? What are your thoughts on coins?
On coins? Oh, you mean like crypto?
No, just literally pennies, nickels, and dimes. I hate them.
I hate them too. I think we should have long gotten rid of the penny. I don't understand why we still have that. It is completely meaningless. But yeah, I'm down with getting rid of the rest of change too. I mean, I'm excited to get rid of all cash, though I realize that that is not something that we can or should be doing, and that excludes a good portion of the population, et cetera, et cetera. But we'll get digital, and we should.
Yep. Speaking about digital, what are some sources of inspiration for you other than entrepreneurs? Since obviously you've got to consume a lot of media in order to be as sharp as you are.
Yeah, honestly, podcasts are the thing that I spend the most time with now. I used to be a voracious consumer of print magazines because I spent my career in print magazines, but I have honestly drifted away from it. And it's because I love the experimental nature of podcasting. The thing about print magazines is that they're largely doing the same thing, same structure, same story structure. You can see the ways that people are experimenting within it. And Taffy, whose last name I can never pronounce, Brodesser Ackner, that's probably not correct. She's currently a writer for the New York Times Sunday Magazine, and she is constantly inventive inside of her writing. And so her writing I read and really love. But for the most part, podcasts is where I get my inspiration from. I'm just fascinated with how much can be done in the medium and how little of it has probably been accomplished so far.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And then last one, person you want to interview and would love to but never have.
I can't think of somebody living.
Okay, they can be dead.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you. This is, let's see if I can like not make the entire show about this answer now. My favorite historical figure is a guy named Emperor Norton. Emperor Norton was a probably crazy man who had walked into a newspaper in San Francisco in the mid-1800s and declared himself Emperor of the United States and later also Protector of Mexico. His name was Joshua Norton, and he was a South African businessman who had moved over there and had lost all his money on a bad deal on rice and then disappeared for a while and then seems to have lost it and declared himself emperor. And then the city, because San Francisco was weird and quirky even back then, just decided to kind of treat him like the emperor. And so he walked around and would preside over events and eventually sold bonds. And it was just, you know, if there was a thing happening at the theater, they would bring Emperor Norton in to kind of open it. And he would write these proclamations in the newspaper. Anyway, I'm just fascinated by this guy. And
Is this going to be your next book? Oh, you read my mind.
I tried to. The problem is that there isn't enough about him to create a compelling and totally true narrative, right? Like, there's lots of little bits and pieces about him, but even the writing style at the time, the newspapers were very dry and just don't have enough to create. And I was like digging through archives and I was trying to find, but you couldn't fill in the blanks. And I was really curious what he was up to and how much he believed of himself and how much of it was almost a survival technique. You know, I mean, you can think this guy was basically Kim Kardashian from the mid-1800s, right? He was famous for being famous. He declared himself famous, and thus he was. Mm-hmm. And there's an interesting long history of people doing that, and he's one of the earliest versions of it in America, and I think that's fascinating. And I would love to just talk with that guy about that.
Is there some type of audio sex tape available from Emperor Norton?
I don't think so. I mean, possibly scratched into some wood. That can be.
Speaking of wood, no, see, I ruined the perfect transition before that. Can we talk quickly about the genesis of Pessimist's Archive? You know, and how you kind of thought that would be a good format for a show? Because I think obviously it's a perfect one, and obviously overlapping so much. And, you know, in order to figure out the future, we have to understand why people have made decisions historically and why they're so scared of change.
Right. So for those who haven't listened to Pessimist Archive, the concept here is that it's a history show about why people resist new things. Each episode, we look at the moment that something new was introduced, something that today we think of as commonplace, like the bicycle or the car or the novel or chess or coffee. And we try to understand why it freaked everyone out, because it did. When anything is new, it freaks people out. And so we want to understand why with each one and then see what we learn about how they overcame it and how it still resonates today. Because when you look back at the things that we were worried about in the past, you can hear the same things that we talk about now just applied to something else. So the way that we talk about the internet now is the way that we used to talk about the telegraph, for example. And this is very interesting to me because I've tried to think about exactly how I first got on to this observation that we repeat our fears throughout history. And I think it might have started with hearing people today talk about how social media is making us lonely and Google is making us stupid and millennial, and just hearing that and knowing it's not true. Like, I am a product of this. I'm telling you it's not true. But we all still seem to say it, and we like that narrative. And whenever Sherry Turkle writes another dumbass op-ed in the New York Times, they'll run it, and it'll get shared a lot. And it just there's something about this idea that we really like, even though it is not true. And we know it's not true because if the same stuff was said 100 years ago about something else, and that wasn't true, like if the things that we have today were at one point considered to be end of times, right? Recorded music, end of times. There was an actual argument like that. I'll take you through it. Like, but here we have it now. It's not harming us, clearly. Why do we think that this time is different? It's not different. This time is not different. We flatter ourselves to think that we're living in special times. We're not living in special times. But people really want to flatter themselves to think that they are and that they're witnessing some kind of critical moment in history. They're not. And so, I don't know. I just started researching and I started tracking down all of these examples. And then I wrote about it for Fast Company when I used to work there. And then very, very weirdly, in 2016, I stumbled upon a Twitter feed called Pessimist Archive. That was doing the same thing. It was like I had this weird interest, and here was this thing that I felt like I made, but I didn't make it. Somebody else made it. And I was like, what is this? So I reached out. It was this guy named Louis, this British guy, and he had made Pessimist Archive. And Pessimist Archive at the time was just a Twitter feed in which he was like crawling through newspaper archives and finding excerpts of things and tweeting them. And so I reached out and I said, let's work together because I'm very interested in this and you're very interested in this. And, you know, I had a lot of experience on camera, and we ended up talking about doing a podcast. And I instantly knew what to do. I was like, well, every episode should be about a thing. We'll just dive into it. We'll find the funny history behind it. And that's what we did. So we started in 2016.
No, I love that. I think also so it's funny that you were just talking about history and just like we were wrong last time and wrong last time. I mean, you know, so Adam, for those of you who don't know, our lovely and capable sound engineer / producer, we were talking about this before the show and basically about those who, what's the phrase? Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm getting it slightly wrong or not, who knows? But I will say that we all know this and yet we don't, you know, become stewards of really studying history and really getting familiar with some of the things that, you know, you're covering. And why do you think that is? Why do you think that we know it's very important, but yet we're just, I mean, again, I don't want to feel like these are interesting times that are so different from ever before,
right?
But is it possible that we're just maybe too busy these days to actually go back and study history and have, you know, some...
No. Well, I mean, I'll just stop you on too busy these days, because of course people have been saying that they're too busy these days.
I was
forever.
Rolling my eyes as I said it. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that was literally in the episode about the Telegraph. Do I open on this anecdote? I might, I can't remember, but where there's this party to celebrate Samuel Morse for bringing the Telegraph forth to the world. And people are talking about how important he was, and it is. He was alive at the time, and then this one guy stands up and just starts railing about how Samuel Morse has made his life busier because he used to be able to go home after work, and work would not interfere with his home life. But now, of course, he can get a telegram at dinner time, and he's got to go back to the office to take care of it. And you know, yeah, that sucks. That totally sucks. But let's not think that we're like suddenly so busy, right? So why do people do it? Well, I think for a couple of reasons. One, there's intellectually understanding something, and then there's emotionally processing it. And those are different things. And I think that we can intellectually understand that rock and roll did not damage a generation. But then once we become of a certain age and we don't understand why the younger generation is reacting to things the way that they are, we think, well, this time is different because I am witnessing it myself. I can't relate to these kids. I don't understand these kids. These kids are talking in a language that I don't understand. Something has to be wrong here. I must be witnessing something wrong. And of course, the intellectual response to that is, no, that's literally what everyone has said since the beginning of time, but that's a really hard thing for us to emotionally process.
Yeah, I think a lot about the kids these days, and I know you cover this about, you know, how they're, lazier than ever before and things like that. And, well, I think there's just always going to be some dissonance between one generation and another, and that's something that has always been true. So
the older generation doesn't want to be replaced.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what's interesting to me also, because at this show and the, you know, based off of the people who I speak to, we're always trying to figure out where things are going to go, and we're often covering new technologies. You know, we just covered infertility, which obviously is arguably fertility is like the first, the original, you know, technology. And I think that there's always some like hesitancy to say that like everything has happened before in exactly the same way, right? Because sometimes it's the same thing thematically, but things are, but there's an element that gets thrown in that changes things. And a perfect example I would say is humans are going to have conflict. They're going to have war. Let's say when you talk about biological weapons or nuclear weapons, that's something that could change things because somebody reacts, but now they have the ability to react and wipe out more people. So what do you say to that general thought? Would you say that certain things can change, but the general impulses of society stay the same?
Yes. I think about it. I think that people confuse the thing with the form. So the thing is a core element of us, of our society, of the structure of our society, of humanness. So community, the desire for community, the desire for communication, the desire for fighting. These are the things. And then the form is whatever form it happens to take in that time. So community equals bowling leagues. There's a form from the 1950s. Or community equals WhatsApp groups. There's a form for now. Are they exactly the same? No, of course they're not exactly the same, but they're an expression of the same thing, which is community, some form of community. And I think the problem that we have is that once we are used to one form, we grow up with one form, and then we get older, and we see that the next generation is not expressing in that form. They're not using the form. They're not going to the bowling leagues. And we equate one to the other. Well, if they don't have the form, then they don't have the thing. If they don't have the bowling leagues, then they don't have community. But that's not true. They just have community in a different way, in a way that you may not recognize, in a way that you may poo-poo, and you say, well, how could they have community over WhatsApp? Well, you know what? They do. So why don't you start with that? Why don't you work backwards from the facts instead of just dismissing the facts and saying you don't understand it. The fact is there's a community. So work backwards from that.
I think a perfect example to me, and this is super basic, is when I hear people talk about, you know, TV being dead, and then you think about how much Netflix people are consuming. Well, that's TV, but like if you're going to be so narrow as to say that, you know, your cable subscription equals TV, and now this new delivery system, but other than that, you're watching it on a TV, right? Yeah. I mean, TV is not dead. Arguably, it's growing in terms of the amount of time, simply because we've got so many options. I can watch TV on the subway now. It's just on a really small screen, and we're just not calling it that.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's not that.
That's right. And also, but you know what? Who cares if TV is dead? I mean, like, who cares if TV is dead? Because the point is, entertainment is not dead. Right. So, yeah, it'll take different forms. Right. We call it TV because of a box that used to sit in our living room that one day will not sit in our living room. And then it'll be a question of whether or not we continue to use the word TV, right, the way that we continue to call our cell phones, even though the phone is the smallest part of what we do on that thing. we might continue to use the language, but who cares? Who cares if it goes away? I mean, right, also, just because something has been around for a couple decades, which, let's keep in mind, TV has only been around for a couple decades, doesn't mean that we need to have it forever.
Yeah, yeah, but the people who are, obviously, there are a lot of vested interests in any one technology and kind of making it like it's a big deal if this thing goes away. But you're right. I think that a lot of people aren't taking kind of a macro view mm-hmm. of history and what actually matters to people. Like, entertainment matters,
right.
But the forms of entertainment have always changed throughout history.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what do you want? If you're in that world, I present to you two choices. Do you want retention of television as we have thought about it for decades to be the hill that you die upon? That's the thing you're going to hold on to? Or do you want to say, you know what? People love to be entertained. I am a good entertainer. I know how to tell stories. I will tell stories in the format in which they want to be told or they want to be received. And then you go there. What do you rather do? Would you rather just hang on to the old technology because it's what we had? Or would you rather go where people are going right now because they still like the thing that you do? They may just not like it in the form that you're used to. And that's okay.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think that it is interesting to look to see the lens that we view some of these things through. So I want to ask you one thing that I don't think you've covered on the show yet, at mm-hmm. least, which is, you know, automation. A lot of people are being afraid of being replaced in some way, shape, or form.
Sure.
I know a bit from history that we've had concerns of being replaced
yeah.
in some way, shape, or form by technology or by other human beings.
Go back to the Luddites.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So what would you say to, you know, what's your general prediction, not having, you know, you don't have to be an automation expert to
yeah.
say, like, where are things going in the short term?
Right. So I think I should say as a acknowledgement of everything that I've said before and also to this question that change can be hard. Obviously, change can be hard. Change is not good for every single person. And our job as a society should be to manage the change, not resist the change, because that's pointless and also ultimately harmful. Because if you resist the change, all you do is still get the change, but you didn't actually get to manage it because you were so busy resisting it. So manage the change, which is to say, try to understand as best we can. And we won't be perfect because we're not actually very good at looking into the future as people. But let's look at what is going to be the impact and then how do we react to the impact. So, you know, automation is not really any different from many of these other changes in that, yeah, it's going to hurt some people. I mean, without question, it's going to hurt some people. But I don't think that it's zero sum. The thing that we are very good at identifying is the thing that's going to get lost. We're very, very, very bad at acknowledging or identifying the thing that's going to be gained because we can't see that, because that's unpredictable. So we can't see what jobs will be created in the future because of the automation. But we know, for example, by looking at the past, that as automation, earliest forms of automations were introduced, and people didn't have to, say, work at the factory as long as they did or maintain the farm there the entire time, or like give people a plow and they're able to work the fields better. And if they're able to work the fields more efficiently, they're able to make more money and have some time to spend that money. And now you've got an entirely new industry, an industry of people who are there to provide services for you because you have some disposable income that just like literally didn't exist a couple hundred years ago. And now here you and I are sitting in this comedy studio, in a podcast studio inside a comedy studio. This is all made possible thanks to leisure time and disposable income. All made possible. But you couldn't have predicted this. And this creates jobs, right? I'm looking around. All these people who have jobs maintaining this place that we're in. None of this was possible without like the plow on a farm. So will it put some people out of work? Yes. Will it put a lot of people out of work? It may. But it's also going to create entirely new industries. It's going to create things that we just cannot possibly anticipate. And I think the thing that we need to do is start to think about how to manage that, but not think about how to oppose it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I don't know. You probably haven't necessarily caught every single one of our episodes. You probably only caught half of them religiously.
A student of it.
Yeah. So that's one thing that we've generally talked about is that not only are we bad at predicting the future, but there are certain obvious, negative things that are going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. We don't know to what extent, but we do know that they're true. And it's very difficult to imagine exactly the positives that are going to come from something, right? And I also think, almost to take a flip side of the whole entire argument of the people who don't look at history in order to better inform the future, I think that sometimes people can sometimes overcorrect for something that happens in their lifetime. I mean, I think yes. a perfect example, arguably, would be after 9/11, and to say, like, so the security, the state that occurred afterwards, and how much more secure did we become? What did we lose as a result of it? I mean, how much of that have you covered, or what are your thoughts on that as to whether or not people overcorrect?
Yeah, a ton. It comes up all the time. I mean, one of my favorite examples of it is, are you familiar with the red flag laws in Britain?
Yeah.
You are? So for those who aren't, that's great. That's like a really random, obscure thing, but I'm glad that you know it. Nice job. The early days of the automobile, the automobile hit the streets. And at the time, the automobile that was hitting the streets was steam powered because in the very beginning of the development of the car, it wasn't clear what the right technology was. You had steam, you had gas, and something else. I can't remember. And so I guess I got to polish up on my anecdote. Anyway, the thing that hit first was steam. And it was big, and it was lumbering, and it was loud, and it was scary. And so the Brits passed the red flag law, which mandated that three people had to be in every car. You had to have the driver, the mechanic, and a guy standing, like, what was it, 60 feet or thereabouts in front of the car, waving a red flag so that people would get out of the way. And these kinds of things, and then there were speed limits and all that stuff. And the ultimate result of this was that it was harder to get new versions of this technology onto the streets, and therefore it took longer to get to the better version of the car. It was such a ridiculous overcorrection that it just hampered the improvement of the technology, which should have been the ultimate goal of the lawmakers at the time. But that's not how we think. How we think is, oh my God, there's this thing, we got to stop it, get a red flag out. And that's just not constructive.
Well, it's funny. Speaking of constructive, this is one thing that I think a little bit about. Like, what the hell is the point of anything? Like, for instance, what the hell is the point of trying to educate people on how to make better decisions if we know that there's almost some type of biological, psychological impulse that's going to lead us to make decisions in the wrong way? I mean, is the answer, 60 years from now, we'll all have a chip that will correct against our poorer impulses as a society? Because I think that part of it is like the futility of us trying to do a better job at informing people, but then knowing that it's not going to totally work.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that's just a tragedy of the human condition, right? I mean, you get enough people together and they'll disagree about how to accomplish something, and it's hard to move forward. I mean, what's the point of it? The point of it is to put good information out there and to try to create, I'm going to use the term safety net, but I don't mean it in some kind of social security way. I just mean it in terms of like an intellectual safety net, like have things out there, have guidelines, have people who can help, have people who are trained in best practices. Not everyone's going to listen, but we don't move in lockstep. And I think that's ultimately for the better, in that sometimes the people who created the greatest innovations of our or any other time were the people who were totally opposed to whatever the status quo thinking was of their time.
Yeah, that's why we're going to have Boris Johnson on next week. Talking about Brexit.
Sure, yeah. He's got nothing else to do.
Right, okay, exactly. I feel like that's a pretty good spot to leave this. I know we could go on and on and on, but I think both of us have little people at home we've got to tend to. So this is really great. Jason, thanks so much for making the time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And thanks to you all for joining us for a slightly different type of episode, but I think it was a really interesting conversation, and make sure to let us know what you thought. I think it's a really interesting thing to kind of delve into the human condition, as Jason put it, and to really kind of figure out how we can be better futurists while at the same time acknowledging that we are not going to be that great at it in general. So, you know, as always, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else suits your fancy. Our sound engineer and producer is Adam Hinneker. Our associate producer is Jason Stack. And once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.